Chi Peng. We're looking forward to now your third and final lecture with us. And as he said, he decided to change his topics around in order to integrate now more spiritual reflections with the closing Eucharist that we have. So once again, let's welcome our good friend, President Chung.
Thank you. I'll be sharing with you this morning on the subject Christian life and witness from an Asian perspective. Let me share with you a couple of news items before I embark on that subject properly. And coming to Seattle, I started from Singapore, of course, and on board the plane, United Airlines, I got hold of, first of all, this Newsweek magazine, all right? Now, by the way, Times and Newsweek magazine and Life, these magazines are very popular in Southeast Asia. We subscribe to them and we read them very frequently. It is very interesting indeed that in this Newsweek magazine, dated September 18th, that I came across an article entitled Money, Power, and Fame. Now, this may have a lot to do with the American lifestyle. So this morning, we are talking about Christian life and witness from an American, from an Asian perspective. Now, here you have an article by Professor Amitai Azioni, presumably Italian, Azioni. Now, who is a professor at Harvard University in the Harvard Business School? And also a university professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Now, this is a reflection of Professor Azioni. The subtitle is, A Professor Stumbles Trying to Teach Ethics to the New Crop of MBAs. Now, you know the MBAs, the Master of Business Administration. Well, not to name those schools, you have very famous schools for that. Besides Harvard, I'm sure you have Yale, Stanford, and all these good places. And this professor, I think, a very conscientious man. A man, I suppose, with very profound and sincere ethical convictions. So as a professor, he was trying very hard to teach these MBAs, executives or executives-to-be, in the area of ethics. And he stumbles. And the big title here is Money, Power, and Fame. I think this article may be short. There may be statements which are too generalized. But I think I was reading between the lines, and I felt that perhaps in a distorted manner, it does say something about the American value system, all right, lifestyle. Now, pardon me if occasionally, as an Asian brother, I tend to be a little bit blunt in order to get the message across. Now, I do not enjoy doing that. If I unintentionally appear to you rather blunt and overcritical, I'm doing it as a member of our big family, all right? So you will take that in that spirit. Money, power, and fame. Unfortunately, that is the kind of perception that many Asians have about you. Not you personally, but about the average Americans. Money, power, and fame. Now, in case you think that I'm doing something in a very detached manner, not so. In a city-state like Singapore, we are very small. Now, we are not part of China. I want you to make sure about that. We take very seriously our national sovereignty. We are an independent city-state. Very close to China, but not quite part of China. It was never part of China. It was under our colonial master, the British. All right, the city-state of Singapore historically was said to have been discovered in the year 1819, by a very famous British explorer, in this case, Sir Stamford Raffles, all right. So our island's history in terms of modern civilization has a history of something like 170 years or 80 years or so. Before that, it was just a fishing village. Now, how big is Singapore? let me try to be a little bit more graphic. From the north to the south is an island of this kind of a shape, 18 miles only. North to south, 18 miles. East, west, 25 miles. That is my country, a small city-state. But you may be surprised to know that in such a small city-state, we have many university clubs or alumni association, and we have a Harvard Club of Singapore. Imagine that in such a tiny city-state, you have a Harvard Club, Harvard alumni, consisting of some 150 members. Quite big, isn't it, for a city of that size? And many MBAs, all right? Many MBAs. And some of them would have been taught or were taught by this professor. So we are talking about something in common. I don't think, honestly, it is easier in any way to teach MBAs about ethics in Singapore. Many of these MBAs serve or work as executives, as your representatives in Singapore, because of their degree or that prestige attached to that degree. Many MBAs, Singaporeans, are put in very responsible position, representing big American companies or multinational companies. So we are talking about things in common. In other words, if indeed this professor from Harvard Business School, Professor Azioni, does have difficulty teaching ethics with these MBAs in the States, I think he would find it equally difficult to teach MBAs in Singapore. So this says something that in that manner, everything seems to be rather global. Now, a few days ago, when I was coming to Seattle, I bought a copy of New York Times. Now, the New York Times on a Sunday is very heavy. As you know, I had difficulty carrying it on board the plane. Besides my two small luggages, I think literally could be about 5 or 6 pounds. That thick. A lot of them, of course, advertisements. And I look at it, and I came across this section on lifestyle. All right, that is my understanding, a distorted one of the American lifestyle. Look at some of these headings. Some very amusing. First of all, this title, "When Just Owning a Car is a Hazard," written by someone obviously in residence either in New Jersey or in New York, complaining about the high parking fees. So just owning a car in the United States, such as New York City, is quite a hazard. Not a very serious program, but as long as it touches people's pocket, it becomes important. Now, what about a Sunday menu about diet? Now, you are a very diet-conscious community, all right? You opt for Diet Coke, Decaf, but when you eat your ice cream, you do not think about anything else. It's very amusing. The Americans' way of diet is very amusing to us. Sometimes they could be as meticulous as Pharisees with food laws. So careful about calories, cholesterol, and so on and so forth. But when you enter into some sort of ice cream shop, everything is forgotten. Everything is forgotten. All right, you behave like Gentiles. Okay. Now, in case you are thinking that I am criticizing you, that is also my soft spot. Okay. Now, here about this one, Sunday menu. Don't frown on beans, even those from a can. Interesting. In other words, beans are supposed to be very good. But here it is, the American value system, about cash. Big one. Can you read from here? Big one. The best source of cash in America today. Wow, the best source of cash in America today. What is it? Remember, I learned the phrase toll-free, you know, toll-free, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. Now, take down the number, Pastor. 1-800, okay? 1-800, the typical 1-800, 542-1245, okay? You got it. Okay, that is not the end. There is also hope for the bachelors and the spinsters. Okay, planning to get married? Be sure to see the wedding and party services guide. And here, the home gets special attention every Thursday in the New York Times. And then if you're concerned about travel, coming to my part of the world, here is good news for you. Number one, to the Far East for far less. Very good. I think those of you who are in advertisement business are genius. You know, those slogans, catchphrase like this one, to the Far East for far less. Beautiful. And in the end, I took some comfort as I read this advertisement. There is also an advertisement about Dr. Billy Graham from London. So there's something religious here for you. Now, I could go on and on. But of course, what I've shared with you is somewhat distorted. But even in a distorted manner, I somehow think that it says quite a lot about the American life and lifestyle. This, I think, have a lot to do with Christian witness and life in this part of the world. I think as a city-state in Singapore, being very cosmopolitan, we are also a consumer society. I don't think we are less a consumer society. So we are talking about a lot of things in common. Now, let us now come back to our subject proper. We began at 8:40. So we began at 8:40, right? Not quite 8:30. So I will stop at 9:40. Is that fair enough? Okay, Christian life and witness from an Asian perspective. Now, seriously, religion for most Asians, I think for that matter, for most Africans, is a way of life. Now, that is very important. Okay, a religion is a way of life. In fact, many years ago, excuse me, there was a professor from India who was chair professor for Eastern religions and Eastern philosophies for many years at All Souls College at Oxford University. Now, he was there exerting tremendous influence, I think must be from 30s until early 50s. Now, he was Professor Radhakrishnan, a familiar face, a name, Radhakrishnan. He was professor for many years at Oxford. Now, being a very devout Hindu, in fact, I think he was more or less a kind of Hindu apologist, very strong in philosophy. Now, he was saying that it is absolutely impossible for a non-Hindu, especially foreigners, to ever understand Hinduism as a religion. He make it very bluntly. It's a futile exercise for any non-Indian, particularly those coming from the Judeo-Christian as well as the Greco-Roman traditions, to ever understand Hinduism as a religion. Now, the point he was trying to say, in fact, he wrote a book, Hinduism, A Way of Life. Now, he was saying, I think, with a great deal of truth, that to understand Hinduism, you really have to be a Hindu, a practicing Hindu. Now, not that all Asians are very religious. Some of them are very pragmatist, I suppose, like some Chinese and Japanese. But for a lot of Asians, they take religion very seriously as a way of life. Now, they may not be very systematic in the presentation of their own theology. You ask an average Buddhist, say, in the land of Thailand, very few of them would be able intellectually to present you what Buddhism is in terms of theology. But Buddhism is part of his and her life. Now, talking about Thailand, that is my area of burden. It is said, and well said, that perhaps until this time, this day, there are perhaps more Buddhist temples than individual Christians in Thailand. I don't think there is exaggeration in that statement, you know, because Thailand is one of our immediate neighbors. I know Thailand quite well in the sense of the religious background. Think of that. There are more Buddhist temples than individual Christians in that land. And I didn't tell you in my autobiographical notes that I was in India together with my wife as a missionary for almost 1 year. You see, after university graduation, as a young graduate, my wife and I spent a year in India as missionaries working particularly with students. I served as a kind of student worker, student chaplain for some years in Malaysia and Singapore. And we spent 1 year in India together. That was very enriching in terms of our experience or lack of experience in service. So we did come into contact with Hindus, devout Hindus. I'm quite convinced that for the serious Hindus, religion is a way of life. Now, this is very different from the way that we look at religion in the Western tradition, because we talk about conversion, we talk about accepting a faith. Very often to Westerners, conversion or accepting Christianity as a religion means just intellectual consent, the conversion of the mind. And therefore, you have the kind of compartmentalization, which is not very healthy. In other words, my religion is a kind of a Sunday religion, isn't it? Because grandfathers, grandparents have been Christians. We come from Norway or from Sweden, and that has been our religion. So I think Sunday is a good time for us to be in the church for an hour or two. I'm not saying that all Christians are like that. Thank God, many are very sincere, many are very committed. But it does have the cultural dimension coming to us as a kind of a heritage. Not surprising at all, it's just like many Chinese, during festival times, New Year time, you know, special occasions, they go to the temple. And the rest of the time, because of practical demands of daily routines, they do not behave quite seriously as Buddhist or Confucianist. So that is very common. I think more so in the West, especially among those educated. To be a Christian is to accept something quite intellectually. Conversion means the conversion of the mind, the change of mind. But that is not enough in terms of Christian life and Christian witness in that part of the world that I come from. There's something very challenging here. For example, remarks are sometimes made about Christians, say in Singapore or in Malaysia. They say, oh, so-and-so, wow, he or she is a Christian, but why does he do that kind of thing? Now, I never heard it said about the Buddhists and the Muslims. Oh, so-and-so is a Muslim. If he's a Muslim, why does, you know, that kind of things happen to him? In other words, people have high expectation. People expect a bit more from the Christians. If you're a Christian, if you commit certain crime, people find it hard to excuse you. If you are a Buddha, a Buddhist, if you are a Muslim, they tend to excuse you. They tend to understand. In other words, somehow or rather, the non-Christians have higher expectation of us. Now, that is itself a burden, but that can be a privilege, that can be a challenge also. In other words, they recognize that being a Christian is a very serious business. A Christian is expected to excel, to do more, even ethically, in terms of good work, than followers of other religions. Now, that is very common in Singapore, in my own little world. That as a Christian teacher, as a Christian colleague, if you have done something wrong, in that circles, people find it hard to excuse you because they identify you as a churchgoer. And as a churchgoer, as a Christian, you are supposed to do better. So if you do fail them, they will not find it so easy to excuse you. Whereas they find it easier to overlook similar crimes or similar mistakes committed by followers of other religions. So as the Apostle Paul says, we as Christians are often put on a stage for people to see, for people to watch. That is itself tremendous opportunities, yet at the same time, it can come to us with tremendous challenge. The people everywhere are watching. Now, from the Asian perspective, I am inclined to think that the crisis of the church, if I may use the word advisedly, the crisis of the church in the West, especially, if I may say so, in Western and Northern Europe, in Western and Northern Europe, the crisis of the church, to me, is both a crisis of faith as well as of life. Faith and life. Of course, the two could hardly be separated, one from the other. Faith determines or should direct our conduct, our life. But if you're talking about, excuse me, crisis of the church in the West, especially in Northern and Western Europe. I will leave America for the time being just to be a little bit more objective, to look at the whole thing objectively. I feel that there is indeed a crisis in the church of the church in the West, both of faith and of life. But in relative terms, I would like to think that perhaps the crisis may be more in the area of life and witness. Why? Because when I examine the confessions of these Lutheran churches in Western and Northern Europe, I find their confessions, their doctrines, still very much acceptable to me. Their confession could be adopted as my confessions. The Oxford Confession, the historical creeds, paying at least nominal subscription to the authority of the scriptures. All this I have no difficulty subscribing, although I do find the theology or theologies of some of the theologians unacceptable to me, especially those theologies which I deem to have departed too far away from the basic teaching of the Word of God. As far as confessions are concerned, or doctrines are concerned, I think that many of the doctrines and confessions of these Lutheran churches in the West are very acceptable. They are very orthodox. It is more in the area of practicing that faith. It is more in the area of witness and life that I feel very much burdensome for these churches. Not that I am better than these brothers and sisters, but that as national churches, state churches, or folk churches, a lot of these confessions have become mere confessionalism. That kind of orthodoxy can be in danger of becoming dead orthodoxy. And that is very deadly. We learn a lot from the Judeo-Christian tradition. When confessions become mere confessionalism, when orthodoxy, right doctrine, right faith, became dead orthodoxy, that is very disturbing indeed. So, ultimately, what is the test? The test is Christian life and witness based on right doctrine. We certainly are very much indebted to our great reformer, Luther, for rediscovering for us the great doctrine of justification by faith only. Not just justification by faith, but many other solas. You know, only. So we are grateful to God for our great reformer, for having rediscovered for us this great doctrine of justification by faith. But I think if we take justification by faith in isolation, this doctrine, which is very biblical, which is very exciting, can have negative repercussions or implications also. Yes, we are justified by faith alone. So after years of reflection, after my conversion, I have come to a position where and when I said, the great epistle to the Romans, where doctrine of justification or justification by faith is cardinal in that epistle, must be read alongside or together with the book of James. That is very important. Very often, as I meet with Lutherans everywhere, the emphasis has always been quite one-sided. The book of Romans, justification by faith. We have, almost like Luther, in his weakness, sometimes tend to forget the message, powerful, challenging, demanding message coming from the book of James. So as the book of James says, faith without work is indeed dead. That is very challenging to us. Yet at the same time, of course, we should be on our guard against the Pharisaic way of looking at faith, thinking that perhaps by mere good work we can save ourselves. That is folly also. So my own humble suggestion would be, as Lutherans, if we take our faith seriously, if we take Christian witness and life seriously, the book of Romans should always be read together or alongside with the book of James to maintain, hopefully, a very healthy balance. When I look at faith, I try to work out a historical line. In our Apostles' Creed, and in other creeds, we believe in the communion of saints. So there is solidarity, there is historical dimension of our faith. In other words, the kind of faith that Abraham had could be appropriated by us by the grace of God. So we share the same faith as the great patriarch, Abraham. So I would like to visualize a historical line when you talk about faith. Yes, Abraham, and then the great prophets, you know, Habakkuk, the faithful shall live by his faith, you know. Abraham, perhaps Moses, Joshua, these people, and the great prophets, and the New Testament, the Lord Jesus Christ, the apostles, and then Augustine, the great reformer, Luther. I would like, after Luther, to include my favorite philosopher, Kierkegaard. Great. If you are Danish, you should be proud of Kierkegaard. I was initiated to his philosophy in the 60s, when existentialism was very popular. So I was forced to get into the writings of some of these great philosophers in order to deal with students, because I was a student chaplain then, you see. They asked a lot of questions. I remember those days, three areas of readings were popular. Castro of Cuba was very popular. Chairman Mao's Red Book. And the existentialists. If you are skeptical or non-Christian existentialist, then you go after Jean-Paul Sartre and these people. And otherwise, you go after Martin Heidegger and these people. And for me, my hero then, as it is now, is still Kierkegaard. And then perhaps Bonhoeffer included, as men of faith. So you have the kind of tradition, keep on challenging us. I see one thing in common amongst these people. I'm sorry to those of you who are ladies, I've given examples from men only, so inclusive, okay? I'm sure there were many women of faith outlined in Hebrews chapter 11, you know. I think I see one thing in common amongst these men, these great disciples of faith. For them, faith and action, faith and witness and life were always bound together. I like this statement made by the writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews in chapter 11, verse 8, describing the faith of Abraham. He says, "By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called, and he went out, not knowing where he was going." That is great to me. Abraham, when he was called, responded and he obeyed. So in the simplicity of his mind, with a clear-cut commitment, he went out, he set out, not knowing where he was to go. A wonderful picture of a pilgrim, of a sojourner, of an alien. And then it continues with these statements. By faith, Abraham sojourned in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents, tabernacles. I like the word tents, because if you pitch a tent, you remind yourself that this residence is of very temporal nature. It is not a solid house, not a temple, but a tent. Now that reminds me of the great statement made by the Apostle John, John chapter 1, verse 14. You know, the Word became flesh. Hologos sarx agenito. The Word became flesh, and dwelt among us. The word dwelt in the Greek, skenao, skene, means the Lord Jesus came to us. He pitched a tent. He didn't build a house and invite all of us to stay with him, just a tent. That suggests pilgrimage. I would like to link the whole idea of Christian life and lifestyle to that of pilgrimage. I think very often this sense of pilgrimage has been lost, because in our pragmatic consumer society, we are caught up with the kind of value system where we long for security. We long for some kind of mortgage. Well, mortgage is a big business, isn't it? But your interest rate overwhelms me. In Singapore, we have very low interest rate, 3%, 4%. Oh yes, banking. Loan, of course, higher. Loan, 6, 7% only. But interest, fixed deposits, 3, 4%. but yours or the New Zealand's high, two figures. I think that is our life and lifestyle. You want some anchorage in life. You want it to be secure. Therefore, everyone wants to be very clever. And therefore, those who are in the era of advertisement are very clever. They are just genius. Go to the Far East with far less. Oh. And some years ago, the Singapore Airlines, not a bad airline, you know, Singapore Airlines, launched a campaign encouraging people to come from Singapore to California. You have the beautiful words, California, here we come. Oh, yes. No, very good. So what I'm saying is, back to Abraham. So in the case of Abraham, I see the idea of pilgrimage. He was challenged, so he went. No sense of security whatsoever. Well, security was back in Mesopotamia, with his kins, with his neighborhood. But here, nothing at all, just naked. Go and set out. And when he was asked to offer up sacrifice, he did it. And therefore, Abraham became a hero for my great philosopher, Kierkegaard, the leap of faith. Absurd. Irrational. Yes, I think Kierkegaard just enjoyed that kind of absurd faith, in quotation marks. Irrational. We try to be very rational. A good man like Jesus was crucified on a cross. That was very irrational. That was absurd. What crime has he committed? Pontius Pilate said, I found no crime in this man. Three times he said it, according to John's witness. Absurd, absolutely absurd, that such a good man should die in my place on the cross. So I think we have to be contented with, in quotation marks, this kind of faith of absurdity, absolutely irrational. But I think it is in this area of so-called absurdity that the Christian faith is marked out, is made so different from other man-made philosophies and alternatives in lifestyle. It's very challenging to me. It honestly took many years for me to just begin to appreciate this paradoxical, dialectical tension in the Christian faith. I think we Lutherans are doing a good job in recognizing the paradox of our faith. I think Christians of other traditions sometimes are trying to be very clever to make it easier to understand. I don't think there's an easy way out from this paradoxical or dialectical tension. So, pilgrimage is our privilege. Being a disciple to me, wherever you are in the States or in Asia, any part of the world, is a very risky business. It's a great adventure. I remember years after my conversion as a university student in the university, I asked a very senior pastor about my future. I'm very concerned about my future. I would like to know 5 or 10, 20 years later what I would be doing or will be doing. And this senior pastor came with great wisdom. He said, brother, time or life can be very boring if it is a kind of a video for you. If you should know what you are going to do 5 years, 10 years, or 20 years later. Life is going to be very boring. It is not going to be very challenging for you. As a Christian, what you need to do is, I do not know what happens tomorrow, but I know who holds tomorrow. In other words, a step each time at a time. That is, to me, adventure together with Jesus Christ. That, to me, is challenging discipleship. Risky business, but at the same time, very adventurous. We're not groping in the dark because we know for sure who is leading us, the Good Shepherd. He is ahead of us, behind us, beside us. And that is very challenging. I find that in Asia, this kind of perception concerning discipleship is very challenging. It is hard to accept initially, but once accepted, it's very challenging. The Christian discipleship is a risk, in quotation marks, is adventure. But you know who walks alongside together with you. And here I must take a recourse to Stephen's speech. We know very well that in Acts chapter 7, Stephen, the first martyr, make an apologia, a defense. I think to put it very simply, correct me, those of us who are New Testament scholars, our director, Dr. Pilgrim included. Now this is my reading, speculation, of that chapter, Acts 7. I think Stephen had a right understanding of history. When we look at the history of the Jewish people in the Old Testament, he was saying something like this. Our patriarchs, our pioneers began as pilgrims, right? God called them, they followed God from place to place. They pitched tent, they had only tabernacles, they had no temple. But in the end, there was this man, David, who had the desire to build a temple for God, and it was rejected personally, and later on, his son, Solomon, built a temple for God. Yes, undoubtedly, that temple was accepted by God to be a place of prayer for Jews as well as for Gentiles. I think the dedication prayer of Solomon is very challenging, even to me today. But anyway, the bad thing was, this temple, recognized and accepted by God, became too institutionalized. It became idolized. So much so that instead of continue to believe in a living God who is always on the move, these people of God had themselves imprisoned or boxed within the four walls of the Temple of Jerusalem. Idolatry, false sense of security was created for them. So the whole thing, the faith which is supposed to be very dynamic, which has a missionary dimension to it, has now become idolized, institutionalized to become a national cult. Exclusive, inward-looking, inbreeding, instead of being a dynamic faith that is to be shared, to be the light for the Gentiles. Now, I will have to ask comments from Professor Hansen, the Hansen from Harvard, to see if this kind of exegesis is acceptable. That seems to me to be the case. From a people on pilgrimage to a people caught up within the walls of their own sanctuary. Now, if that was true, at least partially true, with the people of God in the time of the Old Testament, it can be very true to those of us who are members of historical or historic faith church, such as the Lutheran Church. Is it not the case that very often, now, don't get me wrong, as a big church, you simply cannot avoid structure. There must be institutions, there must be structures. I said it as one who served as secretary of the Lutheran Church, a very small church for 7 years, that was quite enough. And when the bishop one time was not very well, I was acting bishop. Now, it was a funny thought. It was in my 30s, acting as a bishop. Wow, quite something. I felt quite great. Yes, don't get me wrong. I am all for institutions. I think it is far-fetched thinking, romantic thinking, to think that with a membership of 600, you do not have an institution. You must have an institution. You must have structures. You must have all these apparatus. But the danger is that these institutions could become so idolized that those of us who are supposed to be church leaders behave like big company executives and bureaucrats. Now, I have been involved with the Lutheran World Federation quite intimately as a commissioner for 7 years. I see a lot of danger. I don't mean to be personal about it. This is my observation. I see a great deal of danger of those executives occupying those desks. You know, in Geneva, they call this desk, women's desk, theological desk, whatever desk, and the commissions. They behave to me just like executives, in danger of doing so. Bureaucrats. It can be very embarrassing if you should ask a very personal question. Dear director of this department, when was the last time that you talked to a person about Christ? Can be very embarrassing. It can be very embarrassing to me as a principal, as a principal. And therefore, I was telling someone at breakfast that as a principal, I force myself to go out to meetings like this, to meet with pastors and to be challenged. And I take evangelistic meetings in Malaysia and Singapore quite frequently. I take revival meetings also. It's more for the revival of my own soul than for others that I go out. It's very important to stay in touch. So, pilgrimage. This idea is very important. Now, finally, I must follow up what Dr. Paul Hansen started when he quoted from 1 Peter. You remember yesterday, chapter 2, especially verses 9 and 10 about the identity of God's people. You are holy priesthood, and so on and so forth. And therefore, your mission is to declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Now, when I read 1 Peter, never mind about the authorship, okay? 1 Peter. In my own simple mind, I'm quite convinced that at least 1 Peter was written by the apostle. I had a bit more difficulty with 2 Peter, honestly. And similarly, talking about that, if I find easier to accept 1 John being apostolic, I have some difficulty of intellectual kind with John, 2 or 3 John. So we are talking about a little bit of New Testament scholarship, shallow kind. But for me, yes, whoever wrote it is very challenging. I was just looking at those words used by the author, or Peter, describing Christians as aliens, exiles, sojourners. In the late 70s, I came across another modern English translation of New Testament. And he used, instead of exiles or aliens, boat people. Of course, reflecting his empathy or sympathy with the boat people in the 70s, refugees situation. So we are just like boat people, exiles, sojourners, aliens. Now, by definition, aliens and sojourners, exiles, do not, or they are not people of permanent residence. They do not have green card. You know, many Asians coming to the States wanting to have a green card. That will give them security, justify their permanent stay. No, Christians are aliens, sojourners. They do not have citizenship. They do not have green cards to talk about. Their security ultimately rests with God, the living and eternal God, in whom they move and have their being. That is pilgrimage to me. Finally, just three words to describe Christian life and lifestyle, because I have a great deal more, but I must respect the time here. Now, in 1 Peter, the Christian identity, as described in chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, suggests immediately the vital link between identity and mission. Because you are a chosen race, because you are a royal priesthood, and therefore you must declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Now that is the same picture we see in the Exodus events. Because in the Exodus event, I saw immediately this. People of nothing, mere slaves, were liberated. And after the liberation, they were given a new identity as God's people. And as God's people, they were also given a missionary mandate to be a light to the Gentiles. Similarly, our calling, our identity as Christians is inseparable from the things that we do. So Christian life and witness follows just very naturally from our Christian calling, our salvation. If I were to use three words to describe quite inadequately our Christian witness and life, I would use the following three words. First of all, homologia, confession. All right. When we talk about Christian life and witness, we are talking about Christian confessions. But by Christian confession here, I mean not just confessing those great historical and Oxford confessions, that type of confession. Although these are necessary, these are important, they are great theological statements. By homologia or confession, I mean confessing Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior in most concrete terms. In the proclamation of the gospel, in social concern, advocacy, and in many other areas. So I think confession could be made something very dynamic, very concrete. I think people everywhere are expecting that kind of confessions, rather than simply saying on a Sunday, within a particular hour, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. Yes, if indeed we confess or we dare to confess God to be the maker of heaven and earth, then we must be in the forefront in terms of ecological concerns. That to me is challenging. If you think that this is my Father's will, and irresponsible men and women are exploiting it, abusing it, misusing the resources, then we as members, as children of God, should be in the forefront, demonstrating in concrete terms our concern, our actions for the protection. Including Tongass, including Alaska, including Prince William Bay. I look at confession in these very concrete terms. This is very challenging to us as a whole church. Now, in Singapore or in Asia, we as minority church do not have that kind of privilege. I would say it is very difficult to have our voice heard. In most cases, you are being ignored because as Christians, we are minorities, all right? And Lutherans are minorities within minorities. The government, the policymakers are not likely to take you very seriously in many parts of Asia, in the third world. But not so, I think, in America. Although you are not in the major moral majority, although you are not necessarily in the moral majority, but I think the voice of the church is still very important. I think given the right channel and saying it in the appropriate manner, I would like to think that at least I hope that the voice of the churches here in the States, Lutheran churches included, have to be heard by the administration, by decision makers. So you have the kind of advantage, a recognized voice, and you can do something more concrete about it. In Singapore, I may shout and shout. Perhaps in the end, humanly speaking, to no avail, but not here. So I think it means something far greater, far more challenging when you talk about advocacy in this part of the world. You can still do that as a church, at least of a membership of some 6 million. Now, let me voice my concern. Pardon me if I speak out of ignorance. I just can't see how Missouri Synod cannot be a member of the larger church. You pardon me, those of you may say, oh, you are ignorant, you come from Singapore, you do not know enough about Missouri Synod background. Yes, I may be speaking out of ignorance. But I think as a Christian brother, as a Lutheran, I just can't see. I find it hard to see. I'm naive, of course, in this case. How you may not come together. If you are united, then you are stronger. Honestly, when you talk about lobbying, your membership counts. Your size also counts. I think we should try, in the good sense, exploit the kind of situations where opportunities are there. And secondly, and very quickly, another word, apologia, of course, defense apologetics. Now, it is rather unfortunate that the word apologetics, because of the English language, apology, has become a word with some negative connotations. Okay, I offended you this morning, my apology, please. And you accepted my apology. It becomes very negative. And therefore, apologetics has been regarded as a branch of Christian theology which gives you the impression that you are defending all the time. While apologia, as I look at it in the New Testament, especially in the case of Paul, was a very positive exercise. He was arrested. He was asked then to give an account, to explain. It may be to the Sanhedrin, it may be before a governor, it may be before King Agrippa, you see? So positively, and standing on the word of God with clear conviction and courage, the Apostle Paul and others, including Luther, here I stand. And then you make a case for Christ. in your apologetics, in your apologia, you bear witness to the gospel. I think the word apologetics or apologia should be taken in the positive sense also. And that reminds me again of 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. Be always prepared, Peter says. When people inquire about your faith, when people are curious about your faith and your stand and your moral values and your value system, be always prepared to give an account, to give an apologia, to give good apologetics, to witness to Christ. But when you do that, do not do it in any triumphalistic spirit, but doing it humbly and with great reverence. That is challenging to me. And finally, this idea of dialogia, dialogue. Now, coming from Asia, which is the home of practically all great world religions, religious dialogue is not just a theory, it's a daily exercise. When you think of Asia, I would include even West Asia, the Middle East, to be part of Asia. So the Judeo-Christian religion has come from that part of the world. And in that company, of course, are other great world religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, Islam. They've all come from Asia. So religious dialogue is no mere intellectual exercise. But as I share with you, some of you, yesterday afternoon at 4, from 4 to 5, when a question about dialogue was mentioned, I said, by way of example, that is the daily context. I refer to the fact that one of our office staff, office secretary, is a Buddhist. Our gardener, the gardener of the college, is a Muslim. The one who delivers the newspaper to us very faithfully, every day, without fail, is a Hindu. And many of my friends, and I was involved, or have been involved very much in the art society. You know, I like painting. I do a bit of painting occasionally, just to relax my mind. So serving in the art circles led me to some situations where I'm in touch with a lot of my friends, Chinese, who are sincere Buddhists, and the majority of them, intellectual Confucianist. So we are talking about dialogue in those situations. So for us, there is no option, but it's a daily exercise. I'm inclined to think that as you continue here to witness as a church, the American society is being made more and more pluralistic, right? I hope I'm right. You see, in France, in Germany, or in Britain, or in other parts of Western Europe, you see more and more such situations. I forgot how many mosques, mostly mosques, have come up in the last 10 years in Britain alone. In a city like Birmingham, as you know, Birmingham, there is a sizable Islamic community. Now, with Asians, with migrants coming in, with Arabs exercising their or exerting their influence, you are going to see your society becoming more and more no longer homogeneous, but heterogeneous, more and more pluralistic. I think we must be, or we ought to pay a little bit more attention to this area, understanding the cultural religious traditions of these people. How are you to deal with the typical Korean? If you are in California, for example, in Los Angeles, there are many Korean churches, I understand. But a lot of the Koreans are very sincere Buddhists. And some of the Japanese are very informed Zen Buddhists. How are you going to enter into meaningful dialogue with these people? And a lot of the scholars and students from mainland China are either Marxists or people well-versed in the materialistic interpretation of the world and of realities. And therefore, dialogue, dialogia, is very demanding. It's very engaging. It is very challenging to us. Now, talking about this, I must refer to my own situation here, although I began in terms of a discipline theologically in the area of New Testament, which I still teach, in recent years, I am becoming more and more involved in the area of gospel and culture, particularly gospel and Chinese culture. I was talking to Dr. Paul Hansen even yesterday at dinner time about further research in this area. Because when you talk to the Chinese, and you are talking about nearly a quarter of humanity, most of them have come from or have been influenced by two schools of thought, or together, the Marxist-Leninists, which they are very critical of. But that is still their background, their upbringing. And many of those who are not so attracted to Marxism or communism would have come from a background which is still very Confucianist. The reason why I'm going back to Beijing next month, to be exact, October 6th, is to attend an international conference on Confucianism, Confucian studies, because this year is the 2,540th birthday of Confucius. So Confucius was almost as old as Jeremiah or Ezekiel in the 6th century. In fact, the second day after my return to Singapore, you will find me in Sabah, in East Malaysia. Now, in East Malaysia, about 200 church leaders of various denominations will meet together on this symposium, on this subject, pure and simple, with the title Gospel and Chinese Culture. And I will have to give 3 lectures in Chinese on this. Please pray for me. I will have to suffer from the jet lag. I have only 1 day in between, so this is going to be a hard struggle. All right? The lectures will be from 2nd to the 4th of October. And 2 days later, hopefully, you will find me in Beijing. Well, that is my lifestyle. Not a very good one, but it just happened that all these meetings are together. So what am I going to say with the 1 minute remaining? Just to read to you 2 verses to round up the whole thing. In preparation for our Eucharist celebration, I often like to look at the Eucharist being the highlight of our Christian fellowship together, as we gather around the Lord's table. Nothing is more important, perhaps, as we think about the sacrificial work of our Lord Jesus Christ, to think in terms of our own dedication or rededication when we meditate this morning on life, lifestyle, Christian life, and witness. A very familiar verses, Romans chapter 12, the opening verses. I appeal to you, therefore, my dear sisters and brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. That is a great statement. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, so that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. So I leave with you then, my dear sisters and brothers in the Lord, this very challenging statement of St. Paul, calling for rededication and recommitment, so that we may go out from here, challenged by his word, empowered by his spirit, that we may leave this beautiful place, Holden Village, as men and women with greater faith, hope, and love. Amen. Thank you.